Welcome to the October 23rd, 2016 edition of the Emmaus Church Podcast. This podcast is the weekly teaching from Emmaus Church in Buford, Georgia. To find out more about Emmaus Church, go to our website, emmausbible.com. Let's open up our Bibles to John chapter 18 as we listen to Pastor Anson McMahon preach today's sermon titled, The Garden of Gethsemane.
So, a couple nights ago, me and my family had decided that we're really looking forward to it because we decided just to sort of take a night to chill out. I don't know if your family values that, but every now and then life gets crazy and hectic, and you got extracurricular stuff, and we just carved out this evening in our schedule where we said, you know what, on that particular night, we're gonna sit around and do nothing. We're just gonna rest, right? And so we had a plan. And the plan was, I mean, seriously, it was awesome because the plan was that we were all going to be in our PJs by 7 p.m. and we were going to order a pizza and we were going to watch a movie to the glory of God. And that was it. That was our plan. We're going to be together as a family and just chill and watch a movie. And so we ordered a pizza and the pizza got there and my wife was in the kitchen kind of arranging the plates and getting all that stuff ready. We're going to take it to eat it in the living room in front of the TV, right? And So here's the thing. We had to decide on what movie we were watching. And in our home, I usually don't get to watch very interesting things because I'm the only male, right? So there's a lot of princess movies we watch, which Frozen is awesome, by the way. But we watch a lot of princess movies. So we decided to take a vote. And so I went to the girls. My wife's in the kitchen. She's getting plates ready. And I go to the girls. And I was like, girls, what do you want to watch tonight? What movie are we going to watch? What are we going to watch? And they looked at me and they go, we already picked it, Daddy. We already picked it. It's right here. They're waving a DVD. And I said to them, I said, what you got there? And they said, Little House on the Prairie. You want to watch Little House on the Prairie? And when they said it, I cringed. How many of y'all remember Little House on the Prairie? So somebody gave us a box set for Christmas a few years ago. And I looked at them. They said, Little House on the Prairie, Dad, we want us Little House on the Prairie. And I looked at them. Y'all, seriously, I said to them in as stern of a father's voice as I could, like that stern daddy voice, I looked my girls in the eyes and I said, girls, listen to me. Under no circumstances are we watching Little House on the Prairie. Go to that cabinet right there. Go to that cabinet. That cabinet is filled with dozens of movies, and I'm begging you right now. I'm begging you, please pick something else. I'll watch anything, okay? I'll watch whatever you want to watch, I'll watch, right? Elmo, Strawberry Shortcake, the creepy talking train guy, whatever you want to do. Like, I'll watch, baby. I'm just telling you, please, please don't make us watch Little House on the Prairie. Like, I'll watch whatever, right? Your little Nickelodeon movies, right? Sophia the Worst, whatever. Like, I'll watch it. Just please, I'm begging you, please pick something else. I said, Daddy, you said we could pick the movie. We want to watch Little House on the Prairie. I said to him, do you not love your daddy? Don't you love me? Why would you want to do this to me? Now, here's the thing. I'm going to explain a little bit. Because some of y'all are wondering, why in the world does my pastor hate Little House on the Prairie so much? So let me explain. I don't. Matter of fact, I'll be honest with you. Like, I think it's actually a good show. Like, I grew up on some Little House on the Prairie, man. I used to watch the reruns on TBS, right? And I grew up on that stuff, man. I think it's a good moral show, right? It's always got like kind of a solid plot line, and it's good storytelling. It's a good uplifting family show. So it's not that I dislike Little House on the Prairie, y'all. I actually really like Little House on the Prairie a lot. But the problem is this, the reason why I do not want to spend a Friday night with my family watching Little House on the Prairie is because I kid you not, man, every single time we have ever, as a family, watched an episode of Little House on the Prairie, at some point my wife cries. That's not a joke. That's not a joke. Like that, I'm being totally honest with you. There comes a moment in the show where something happens, it's like the writers sat down and said, okay, when's are the women are going to cry moment, right? And it's like that there's some moment where my wife gets, she gets verklempt and she weeps. And I'm left in this very precarious situation of what do I do now? It's weird. Like every episode, literally every episode, there's something that happens. Charles Ingalls spends a year's salary to buy his wife the plate she's always wanted. And so he makes me feel like a loser of a husband. And my wife's weeping, right? She's weeping. One of their kids has a tragic accident and goes blind. Not how I want to spend my Friday night, right? The family horse who's the favorite horse, gets hurt, breaks his leg, and they have to shoot him? So I got a crying wife and kids who are like in, you know, need counseling? And I don't even know what to do, man. I'm telling you, man, like this is, it's in moments like this where it is evident I need to take a class on how to be a better husband. Like, I'm so glad we got a marriage conference coming up this weekend, because I'm hoping that one of the sessions is what to do when your wife starts to cry during a show, right? Because I have, they didn't cover this in our premarital counseling years ago, right? The pastor didn't mention it, which he should, by the way. He should. That should be a part of premarital counseling. Pastor should look at you and say, okay, cool. We've covered the gospel. We've covered your love for Jesus. We've covered finances. Now let's get to the really important stuff. What do you do when your wife starts to cry during a movie, right? Because I have no idea what to do. And so I always make it awkward, right? So there's my wife weeping on the couch watching Little House on the Prairie. And my response is, I scoot up next to her, closer. I put my arm around her very awkwardly. And then I try to speak. I try to say something comforting. It's okay. It's okay, baby. They had to shoot the horse. He broke his leg, but he broke his leg. You don't want him to be in pain, do you? Huh? He's in horsey heaven. Aren't you glad he's in horsey heaven? Right? She's like, get away. She's crying worse, right? So here's the point, family. Here's the point I want you to get. Like, in those moments, I feel totally helpless, right? In those moments, I have zero control. Absolutely no control. Now, here's why I tell you that story, family. Here's what I tell you the story. When we get to John chapter 18, here's what's going to happen. It's going to begin to appear as if Jesus has lost control. Like before we get to the text, here's what you need to know. When we get to John chapter 18, it begins to appear at this moment as if Jesus is completely helpless. It begins to appear as if Jesus has lost control, right? It begins to appear at this moment as if the world is more powerful than Jesus. That's what it's going to look like. And I'm telling you, family, don't miss this. Something is about to happen right here that's going to tempt every single one of us to believe that Jesus has officially lost control, that Jesus is not in control of the circumstances that surround him. And let's be honest, family. Let's just be real. We all have seasons of life that we all walk through where it feels to us like Jesus is not in control. Could we be honest about that? We all walk through these seasons, man, where it feels as if Jesus really isn't in control after all. It's those moments when it's really easy for us to believe that Jesus doesn't hold the whole world in his hands, that Jesus isn't in control of circumstances, those moments when our world feels like it's been tossed upside down and that somehow Jesus isn't a sovereign king after all, but instead the world is controlling the circumstances and the world is more powerful than Jesus. And we all know what it's like, family, if we're honest, if we're real, we all know what it's like to walk through moments where we begin to doubt that Jesus is in control in the first place. Your husband tells you that the marriage is over and he's leaving, right? The doctor wants to have a meeting with you because it is cancer. You go to have that ultrasound and the baby's heart isn't beating, right? You have no money, you have no food, and you have no idea how you're even going to make it because the math doesn't work. A person you love with all of your heart dies. And let's be honest, family. Let's be honest, beloved. It is in those moments of tragedy. It is in those moments where it feels like your world has been tossed upside down, when it's really easy and really tempting for you to cry out, I thought you were in control, Jesus. Where are you, Jesus? Are you paying attention, Jesus? The pastor said that you were in control, Jesus, but I'm starting to think he's a snake oil salesman, Jesus, because I don't see it, Jesus. Like, are you even paying attention? And just so you know, family, watch this. Just so you know, this is why John chapter 18 is so amazing and rich and thick and such a treasure, beloved, because in this chapter of the Bible right here, we begin to discover that in those moments when it seems as if Jesus is not in control, guess what? He actually is still in control. And believe it or not, he's actually still good. And he's even actually up to something very specific in your life. This chapter is such a treasure, man. It's 11 verses we walked through this morning. It's such a treasure. So let me show you what I'm talking about, family. John chapter 18, and pick it up in verse 1. And as always, beloved, if before we dive in, just in case this is your first Sunday here in Emmaus, welcome, and we're so glad you're here. And maybe it's your first Sunday. Maybe you've been out for the past few weeks and getting plugged back in and making this a part of your weekly rhythm. But whatever the case may be, if you're here for the first time in a long time or here for the first time today, here's what you need to understand before we even preach this. When we get to the end of John chapter 17 and the beginning of John chapter 18, understand this, man. Jesus Christ is just a few hours away from being crucified on a Roman cross. Like that moment, it's literally just a few hours, just a couple hours away from happening. And Jesus just eaten one final meal with his disciples that he loves so much. We, over the past really 3 or 4 months, have been walking through this one night. Jesus just finished up this final meal with his disciples, and at some point during this final meal, there comes a moment where one of his disciples, a man named Judas Iscariot, gets up from the table, excuses himself, walks out of the door because he has decided to betray Jesus. And it's fascinating, family, because during that meal, after Judas leaves the room, Jesus begins to explain to his disciples that it is now time for him to do exactly what the Father has sent him here to do in the first place. And Jesus is referring to the cross. Jesus is referring to what's going to happen in just a few hours when he dies. And then Jesus prays for his disciples. And as we saw last Sunday, how mind-blowing is this? Jesus even spends some time praying for us. We walked through that last Sunday. And then follow this, family, because after all of that has taken place, after Jesus has shared this final meal with his disciples and Judas has left to betray him, and he's spent some time with his disciples explaining to them what's about to happen, and he's prayed specifically for them and for us, after all of that has happened, then we read this. John chapter 18, verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Now, time out for a second, family. We need to address some things. I want to point out something here. One of the very first things you need to understand whenever you're reading John chapter 18 is that there is actually a significant gap of time that occurs between verse 1 and verse 2. You need to know this. There's actually a span of time that passes here between verse 1 and verse 2. And what's interesting is that John, here in the Gospel of John, really doesn't expound on it at all, doesn't tell us exactly what happened there. Many scholars believe that's perhaps because John's Gospel was the last Gospel to be written, and John knew that we already had the information of what happened during that span of time between verse 1 and verse 2. But it's interesting, family, because you can actually read in pretty graphic detail what exactly occurred during that span of time if you read the other Gospels. So if you spend some time reading Matthew or Mark or Luke, you're going to specifically read what occurred during that span of time between verse 1 and verse 2. And if you do that, family, just telling you, if you do that, what you will discover is that Jesus was overcome by an unspeakable horror in the Garden of Gethsemane. Horrible. Far worse than anything you and I have ever experienced. And many of us have experienced some dark days. But Jesus, the horror that he walked through in the Garden of Gethsemane, that he experienced in the Garden of Gethsemane, was beyond anything that you and I even have a frame of reference for. For example, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell us about this. So for example, Matthew tells us in his gospel that in the Garden of Gethsemane, at one point, Jesus actually cried out at the top of his lungs. He said, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death." That's what Jesus said in the garden. Jesus Christ, our great God and Savior, right? God in the flesh, like never committed a sin. Jesus cried out, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow, even to the point of death." And what he was literally saying at that moment, beloved, is this. He was saying, my sadness is killing me right now. The Son of God said that, y'all. My sadness is killing me. Additionally, Mark tells us that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus repeatedly collapsed over and over again onto the ground. It's pretty intense to read. He would literally fall down. Get this picture. Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's crying out that his soul is sorrowful, even to the point of death. And Mark tells us that at this moment, Jesus he would literally get up and he would walk a few steps and he would collapse, and then he would get up again and he would walk a couple steps and he would collapse again, like over and over and over again. Beloved, let me ask you a question. Have you ever been so overcome with sadness and despair that you literally could not even stand? That was Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Furthermore, Luke tells us in his gospel that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was in such horrific anguish that he sweat drops of blood. It's fascinating, man, because that's not fairy tale hocus pocus stuff. Physicians today actually tells us that this is a real, extremely rare condition known as hematidrosis, and it only affects certain people who are experiencing unbelievably horrific and extreme distress. And that's the Garden of Gethsemane, beloved. That's the Garden of Gethsemane. It's that season, follow this, family. Here's what the Garden of Gethsemane is. It's that season of unreal darkness. It's that season of unbelievable despair, right? It's that season of excruciating anguish, of excruciating emotional pain. And that's the Garden of Gethsemane. Family, listen, the Garden of Gethsemane is that season of life that you so wish you didn't have to walk through, but you do have to walk through. Right? And let's be honest, y'all. Some of you this morning are walking through a Garden of Gethsemane today. And it's hard, man. It's difficult because if we're being honest and if we're really talking about these seasons of life we walk through that are filled with despair and filled with discouragement and filled with pain and filled with anguish, the reality is, man, it's at this moment in your Garden of Gethsemane when you might be tempted to wonder, man, where is God in all this? Where's God? Has God lost all control? Like, is God even in control anymore? Is God losing this battle? Like, right, that's what happens in the Garden of Gethsemane. We're tempted to ask, does God even care? Does God even know? Is the world winning? And some of us are walking through it today. And if you're not walking through it today, then odds are you know what it's like to walk through it. We've all been there. And some of you have been in the Garden of Gethsemane before. Some of you have been there at some point in your life. And here's the deal. If you're walking through this season today of despair and of darkness and of anguish, I hope that somehow by God's grace, you get a little encouragement from this truth right here. Jesus knows what it's like in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus knows what it's like. Because he too has been in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then there comes this amazing moment, beloved. There comes this amazing moment after sweating drops of blood, after collapsing onto the ground repeatedly in anguish and despair, after crying out in desperation to his Father in heaven, after all of that, beloved, there comes this incredible moment when Jesus, he gets up off the ground and he dusts himself off. And he wipes those drops of bloody sweat away from his forehead because Jesus knows what has to be done in this Garden of Gethsemane. He's in despair, he's in anguish, he's wrestling, he can't even stand. And then at some point, he gets up, he wipes himself off, he wipes the bloody sweat off, and he's resolved to do what he's got to do. And that's when we read this. Look at verse 3. Jesus knows what has to be done in the Garden of Gethsemane. Verse 3. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one." Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" Now, we got to pay close attention to what just happened here, family. We got to back up a little bit, and we got to actually comb through this thing and see what exactly happened and not miss it, because here's what's so fascinating, beloved. Like, in these verses right here, Jesus, I don't know if you noticed this, Jesus in these verses is having an encounter with three very specific people or groups of people. You got to see this. In these 11 verses, Jesus Christ, our great God and Savior, is having an encounter with three very specific people or groups of people. We got Judas Iscariot, right? We got the soldiers that come to arrest him in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then finally, we've got his disciple Peter. And we read specifically in these 11 verses about the encounter that Jesus has with each one of these cats, right? With Judas Iscariot, with the Roman soldiers who have come to take him in, and with his disciple Peter. And here's what's crazy, family. Here's where we're going, okay? If you look closely at all three of these individuals or groups of people, here's what happens. We actually see ourselves in every single one of them. It's like it's crazy. Like, I'm just telling you. It is like looking in a mirror, like it really is. It's like putting a mirror up in front of you and seeing yourself. Like, if you look closely at these people, you see you. And I see me, right? And some of y'all don't believe me, so that's why we're preaching this sermon. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Here we go. First of all, and as we gather in MCs, our missional communities this week, this is what this is about. So we'll put these up on the Jumbotron, and we want you to see these, okay? First of all, number one, understand this, family. Number one, we can see ourselves in Judas. Follow this. If we look closely at what's happening here in John 18, we can clearly see ourselves in Judas. And here's how. Look at verse 1 again. Look at this. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, watch it, who betrayed him, also knew the place. For Jesus often met there with his disciples. Translation, y'all. Judas used to be one of Jesus' boys, right? You read the Bible, you read the Gospels, then you know this, man. Like, they used to hang out. That's what that means. Judas and Jesus used to hang out. They used to kick it together, like on a daily basis, man. They were always around one another. They used to chill out around the same campfires. They used to kind of, you know, pass the same leg of lamb around, and the community leg of lamb, right, to all the disciples. They used to laugh at each other's jokes. They used to be together, spend quality time together. They ate at the same table, broke bread together, spent holidays together, right? For 3.5 years, man, Judas and Jesus were friends. Don't miss that image, y'all. Matter of fact, here's what's so crazy. Matter of fact, man, Jesus and Judas were so tight. They were so close that Judas even knew all of the places that Jesus liked to hang out. Judas actually knew all of the places that Jesus liked to frequent. Judas knew what Jesus would probably be doing at this moment. And according to John chapter 18, that's why Judas knows about the Garden of Gethsemane. Now follow this. These guys were friends. These guys were close. And then at some point, something very tragic happened. Okay? And we know that something very tragic happened because of what verse 4 says. Watch verse 4. Look at this. We know something tragic happened because of this. Verse 4. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Watch it. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. Do you see it? Judas, who betrayed Jesus, was standing with them. Well, who's the them? Them is the guards who have come to arrest Jesus. And so Judas, for 3.5 years, stood with Jesus, followed Jesus, went everywhere where Jesus went, was taught by Jesus, was in the inner circle of Jesus, and he stood with Jesus. But then something happened to cause Judas to go from standing with Jesus to now standing with the enemies of Jesus. So the question becomes this, beloved, like what in the world could possibly cause a man who used to stand firmly with Jesus to now on this night be standing with the enemies of Jesus? What could cause a man to go from standing with Jesus to standing with the enemies of Jesus? And the answer is this. Ready? The answer is this, family. At some point, Judas began to love the things of this world far more than he loved Jesus. That's what happened. See, man, here's what you got to understand. So again, you have to read the Bible. It's a great book. You got to read this. And when you read it, when you spend some time reading it, what you'll find out is that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels are actually very clear about the fact that Judas was with Jesus in his inner circle. As a matter of fact, Judas was not just with Jesus. Judas actually was the treasurer of the group. He kept the money bag, and the Gospels actually tell us that at some point along the way, what began to happen is that Judas began to pocket some of the money that was specifically given to fund the ministry of Jesus. Holding the money bag, the treasurer. People are donating money to fund the ministry of Jesus, and next thing you know, Judas takes a shekel here and a couple of shekels there. Who will ever find out, right? And then eventually, when it came time to betray Jesus, well, Judas would betray Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Now, you think that's an accident? You think that's just coincidence, man? That's not just coincidence. No, man. Beloved, please don't miss this. This is a big deal. Please don't miss this. Over a long, drawn-out period of 3.5 years, Judas Iscariot began to love the things of this world. Very slowly, man, began to love the things of this world more than he loved Jesus. And eventually, what happened? He found himself standing with the enemies of Jesus. Wasn't overnight. Wasn't some crazy dramatic shift? Over a long period of time, over a few years, Judas began to slowly love the things of this world far more than he loved Jesus. And now on this night, he finds himself standing with the enemies of Jesus. And family, here's my question for you this morning, okay? That brings us to this. Here's my question for you. Who are you standing with today? Who are you standing with? Consider that, man. Like today, who you standing with? And by the way, I'm not talking about 3 years ago. I'm not talking about 10 years ago. I'm not talking about, well, I was a strong Christian when. No. Y'all understand, Judas could have given that. Judas could have said, yeah, a few years ago, I was standing with Jesus, right? So I'm not talking about in the past. I'm talking about right now, family, today. Like, who are you standing with today? Like, another. And by the way, I'm not just asking what you would say. I'm asking this, what does your life say? Right? That's what we're asking. What does your life say about this, man? like how we live and what our affections are stirred by. Like what does your life say? Another way we could ask the question, maybe this will be helpful. Another way we could ask the question, beloved, is this. What are your eyes fixed on? What drives you, man? What motivates you to make the decisions you make? Like what are your eyes fixed on? Are your eyes fixed on your money? Are your eyes fixed on material possessions and these things around you that you just have to have and that you want and that you even want more than you want God? Are your eyes fixed on your body? Fixated with, obsessed, or totally obsessed with, more than you're even obsessed with following Christ. You're obsessed with what you look like and how much you weigh. Are your eyes fixed on someone else's body? Filled with lust? Are your eyes fixed on your career? It's all about climbing that ladder. It's all about making a name for yourself. Are your eyes fixed on this crazy election season that has been quite chipper, right? What are your eyes fixed on, family? What are your eyes fixed on? Who are you standing with today? Right now, at this moment, not a couple years ago, today, who are you standing with? We could even ask it this question, family. What do you love most today? Or even better yet, who do you love most today? Is it Jesus? Are you standing with Jesus? or did you used to be? And over a long, drawn-out period of time, a little compromise here and a little compromise there, and the next thing you know, you take inventory of your life and my, how you see how your heart has moved. We all battle with this, man. We all struggle with this. Beloved, I'm begging you. Listen, I'm begging you. Please do not miss the tragic lesson that is the life of Judas Iscariot. Please, family, do not miss the huge blinking warning sign in neon, right, that is the life of Judas Iscariot, man. Like he took his eyes off of Jesus over a long period of time until one day, beloved, he was no longer even standing with Jesus. And one of the things that we learn from this, follow this, one of the things that we learn from the life of Judas Iscariot is this right here, family. Whatever we give our attention to most will always shape our thinking and train our affections. That's the truth. Say it again. Whatever we give our attention to most will always shape our thinking and train our affections. Meaning, that thing will always direct how we feel, our moods, how we treat others, our disposition towards others. Whatever we give our attention to most will always shape our thinking and train our affections. And if you don't believe me, go to a college football game in the South. We see ourselves in Judas Iscariot. Additionally, if we're honest, we have to admit this, family. Number two, we see ourselves in the Roman soldiers. Follow this. Not only do we see ourselves in Judas Iscariot, really clearly, but we see ourselves in the Roman soldiers. This is really interesting. So explain what I mean. Do you see what happened here, Emmaus? It's so crazy. Look at verse 4 one more time. You can't miss this. Look at verse 4 one more time. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now, here's what's so insane about this, family. First of all, we're told here that this was a band of soldiers. That's what we just got told. This was who came to meet Jesus in the garden was a band of soldiers. What's fascinating about that in particular is that this band of soldiers, that phrase there, it's actually a Greek phrase that literally means a cohort of soldiers. That's what that means. Now, here's why that matters. A cohort of Roman soldiers was, get this, beloved, 600 soldiers. 600. 600 soldiers. So we gotta be careful. Like, I don't want you having in your mind this image of you got Judas and you got a couple high priest guards or whatever, and then you got like Larry, Moe, and Curly, three Roman soldiers, right, coming out to get Jesus. That is not how this thing went down. Like, we got according to the text, we got 600, or at the very least, hundreds of Roman soldiers who have come out to arrest Jesus in this garden. 600. So in other words, that affects the way you read this text now. So understanding that, it totally changes the way you read this text, because what we just got told, beloved, get this picture. We just got told that Jesus, I mean, how boss is this? Jesus steps up to this band of 600 soldiers, and he asked, and notice, they didn't come find him. They didn't, like, you know, go into the shrubbery and find Jesus hiding. You know, Jesus didn't run. Jesus didn't avoid him. Jesus didn't take Peter hostage and say, I got your man. That's not what happened. Jesus presented himself to them. Here's them coming up, and Jesus himself walks out of the shrubs, walks out of the trees, looks at these 600 soldiers and those who are accompanying him, and he asks them this question, whom do you seek? How awesome is that moment? Whom do you seek? They said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus immediately strikes back with, I am he. Now, you got to understand what's going on under the surface, because we, in our English, we just read that and go, okay, Jesus just identifying himself, saying, I am he. But there's something far greater happening here, beloved, because when Jesus says the words, I am he, those words, I am, that Jesus just used right here are specifically the words, ego, I me, ego, I me. And ego, I me is important because those Greek words translate for us the exact title that God gave himself to Moses at the burning bush when he said, I am that I am. Meaning what Jesus just said is not, has a double meaning. It doesn't just mean I am Jesus of Nazareth. It means I am God. And when Jesus says, I am God, immediately at the very moment those words come out of his mouth, 600 Roman soldiers fall backwards faster than an old lady at a Benny Hinn conference. This is awesome. This is amazing. Now, here's the deal. I don't know about you, but I'm thinking to myself, I've been thinking about this all week. I'm going, man, okay, let's imagine I'm one of these Roman soldiers. I'm one of these Roman soldiers. I'm there standing in this big crowd of Roman soldiers. And let's imagine, like, if this was me, I'll just be honest with you. I might be having second thoughts about arresting Jesus at this point. That's the way I'm thinking. I'm going, man. Okay, so if I'm there, if I'm there and I see this happen and I hear Jesus say, I am he, and I just got knocked on my backside along with 599 of my closest friends by those words, I'm having second thoughts, man. I might even be saying, hey, man, here's the deal. Here's the deal. I don't know a whole lot, but here's what I do know. I ain't slapping handcuffs on the guy who just beat me up by saying a verb, okay? So I'm done. I'm going to get a new job. I'm out. Y'all have fun, right? I'm just saying, man, let's think about this for a second. Like, I might be having second thoughts, and that, beloved, listen, that's the craziest part of this whole story. The craziest part of this story is not that Jesus just knocked down these 600 guys by saying a few words. That's not even the trippiest part. The trippiest part is this, beloved. The insane part is that immediately after Jesus knocks these guys around with his words, just by saying things, after he does that, what do these brothers do? They get back up. And they completely ignore the fact that they just experienced the power of Jesus up close and personal. They act like it didn't even happen. They ignore it. I don't know if you've ever read any John Calvin. You should. It's hilarious. I love John Calvin. Like, I love John Calvin stuff, especially his commentaries, because he pulls no punches when talking about people like this. And I was reading Calvin's commentary on this past week about, you know, out of John 18. People don't talk like John Calvin, Martin Luther, or Charles Spurgeon anymore. That's part of the problem, is that preachers don't talk like them anymore. I'm telling you, when I get into eternity, I want to see Jesus. I want to spend time with Jesus and worship Jesus. And then at some point, I really want to have a latte with John Calvin, Martin Luther, and Charles Spurgeon, because it's going to be awesome. Listen to what John Calvin says about, specifically about these Roman soldiers and their response here. In John 18, listen to what Calvin says about this. I love this. He starts off by saying this. We put him on the jumpstart. He says, how dreadful is their stupidity? Which, that alone is awesome. People don't talk like that anymore. That is a greater insult than just saying, hey, you're really stupid. Don't say that. Go John Calvin, man. How dreadful is your stupidity, right? It just hurts. It hurts more. How dreadful is their stupidity when, by a just judgment of God, they have been bewitched by Satan. Oxen and donkeys, by the way, he didn't use the word donkeys. I just didn't want to feel the emails this week. Oxen and donkeys, if they fall, are touched with some kind of feeling. But those men, after having had an open display of the divine power of Christ, proceed as fearlessly as if they had not perceived in him even the shadow of a man. Nay, Judas himself remains unmoved. Let us learn, therefore, to fear the judgment of God by which the reprobate delivered into the hands of Satan become more stupid than brute beasts. You know what he just said? Family, here's the in a nutshell, here's what Calvin just said. These guys are acting like a bunch of fools. Could there be a bigger fool? To experience the power of Jesus in your face so much so, it's so dense, it's so thick, it's so real that it knocks you over and you get back up and pretend like nothing even happened. Jesus just put his amazing power on display and they ignore it. They move on. They act like it didn't even occur. And here's the convicting part about all that, family. We are the same way. That's where it gets convicting. Every single one of us in this room are exactly the same. We do this same thing all the time. Think about it, y'all. So we're like, no, I don't. Okay, well, I'll prove it to you. Think about it, family. There was that moment when you were going through that really rough time, that time of need, right? That time of need. I'm going through a time of need. And it was so hard, man. And it was so discouraging and it was so dark and there's a season of life that was so difficult, man. And you prayed and you prayed and you prayed and you even had a few other people that you love and that you trust praying for you. And at some point, Jesus showed up. He showed up and he showed off and he flexed his muscles and he showed that he can do anything. And he blew your mind with how graciously he provided for you. He did more than you could even ask or think or imagine. It was beyond what you were even hoping for and praying for. Like, he showed you his glory. He showed you his power. He showed off. But then soon after that happened, what'd you do? You forgot all about it. And you moved on. And eventually, when you started to experience yet another time of need, you know what you did? You didn't trust God. You didn't believe that he was in control. You didn't expect him to provide. You didn't even take time to intentionally remember all of the other times when God has already come through for you throughout history. But instead, what did you do? You freaked out, man. You freaked out and you lost your mind and you let it affect the relationships around you and the way that you treated people and you got worried and you even started to get mad at God because he didn't fix that thing in 5 minutes like you wanted to. How dare God not fix your problem in 5 minutes? See, Mace, the point is this. We should not be so quick to cast judgment on these soldiers here in John chapter 18 because here's the truth, man. Our memories, just like the memories of these soldiers, tend to be very short. We're just like them. About 15 years ago, man, I just got married to my wife, Heather. And when we got married, I was taking seminary classes and I was also doing itinerant ministry, itinerant preaching full time, which basically is just a fancy way of saying I was traveling every week, preaching at all these different random small churches, always new city, and I was 20 pounds overweight because I was living off McDonald's double cheeseburgers, right? That's what itinerant preaching means. And so I was doing that all the time. And here's what happened. Because I'm a total moron when it comes to finances and taxes in particular, what I did not understand and I didn't realize is that traveling full-time and preaching in all these different churches qualified me for what's known as self-employment taxes. Praise the Lord. I didn't know this. Who knew? I didn't know. So imagine my surprise and my chagrin when a couple months after I was married, I got a letter. I received a gracious letter from the Internal Revenue Service. God love them. Informing me that I owed them $3,000 in back self-employment taxes. Praise the Lord. So here's me. Picture this. Here's me and my wife, Heather. We've been married for all of 3 months at this point. And we're newlyweds, already broke, living off ramen noodles, right? Have no money, living on love, right? And now I find out I owe $3,000 to Uncle Sam. And both of us were freaking out. I mean, I'm telling you, it was so hard to trust God. And I'll be honest with you, I was even tempted to get angry at the Lord at this. I got angry at God during this season of my life, y'all. Like I have never been this angry at the Lord ever in my life. But in this season, man, I just had rage because I'm thinking to myself, are you serious right now, Lord? Really? Seriously? Like, I'm out here preaching, like, every week. I'm hardly ever seeing my wife. I'm living off processed meat from Wendy's all the time. I'm getting paid love offerings of $150 a pop at these churches, man. And now I owe $3,000 to the government? Yippee! It's like a bad country song, man, right? It was just terrible. Terrible. Like, I was getting depressed and eating more processed meat, right? And then, true story, here's what happened. I go to preach at this church. I get invited. It's just another church, another youth event. Just like all the other youth events I've ever done. Nothing spectacular out of the ordinary about this youth event. Like every other youth event I've ever done, right? Tons of teenagers, tons of pizza, tons of nasty middle schoolers. And I'm there and I'm preaching. I'm just saying they're nasty, y'all. I love them, but they're nasty. And we do the closing session. The closing session happened. The Sunday morning session, I'll never forget, I preached at this weekend for the very last time, that final morning, and I was finished preaching, and I began to walk off stage, and I'm walking down the side, much like these stairs, and the worship band begins to play some passion song or whatever, and I walk down here, and that's when I met at the side of the auditorium, I met by a man who stuck his finger in my chest and stopped me. Never met this guy, never seen this guy before in my life. He sticks his finger in my chest, y'all, and he says to me this. He says, now listen, this is going to sound really weird to you and you don't know me, but I'm just going to tell you this. I was standing in the back of the room while you were preaching, and I heard clear as day the Holy Spirit tell me, you need to go up to that man, and you need to ask that man what he needs. So that's what I'm doing right now, man. What do you need? And here's me being uber spiritual. I looked at him, I said, well, I just need prayer, brother. I just need prayer. If you could just pray for me, brother, that'd be great, right? I need to lose some weight. I'm eating processed meat, right? I just asked for prayer. I began to ask for prayer, and I'll never forget this, man. This brother looked at me and he said, no, don't do that. I know what I heard. What do you need? So now all these defenses just broken down, man. And I literally looked at this brother and said, well, my wife and I just got married, and I found out I owe a lot of money to the IRS. I didn't even tell him out. I just said, I owe a lot of money. A lot. And he got this huge smile on his face. And he said, boy, give me your address. So I wrote down my address and I gave it to him. And the very next week, I went outside and I checked our mailbox. And in our mailbox, there was an envelope. And inside that envelope, there was a letter from this man along with a check for $3,000. That's the truth. My wife is here. You can fact check that junk. She's here. You ask her. Like, this happened, man. This actually happened. That's a true story. And here's the deal, man. All the atheists in the house, I love you, but I'm just telling you, man, you can continue to deny God if you want to, but just so you know, there are moments like that occur from time to time where God unmistakably puts his glory on display and makes all the haters look like fools. I'm just saying. Like, this happened, y'all. I didn't read that in a book. I didn't see some preacher tell that story. This happened to me. It occurred. Like, I tasted and saw this experience. And you can argue with my theological position or what I believe about this book, but you cannot argue with what actually happened to me. Like, this actually occurred, man. It happened. But you know the crazy part, beloved? The crazy part is that we're all alike. I'm just like you. You're just like me. And this amazing thing happened to me like a miracle that can only be explained by Jesus showing up, showing off, and knocking me over with his glory. And yet my memory, just like these soldiers, has a tendency to be incredibly short. And in my moments of need, and in my moments of uncertainty, and in my moments of financial instability, I am still so tempted to freak out and refuse to trust the Lord. See, Mace, here's the point. I'm just like these soldiers, and you're just like these soldiers. Because time after time after time, it's as if King Jesus can put his glory on display in our lives on a Tuesday night, and by Wednesday morning, we've completely forgotten. And then finally, when we look closely at what's going on here in John 18, we see ourselves in Peter. We see ourselves in Judas. We see ourselves in the Roman soldiers and family. We see ourselves in Peter. Here's how. Watch this. Did you see what Peter did here, family? I struggle with this. I struggle with it because I read it and I think what Peter did here is really awesome and really dumb at the same time. According to Jesus, it's really dumb. But my flesh says it's awesome. So here's what happens. Check this out again. Look at verse 10. Verse 10. So all this happened, that the guards show up, the soldiers show up, they're knocked over, but they've come to arrest Jesus. They're about to arrest Jesus. They're about to slap handcuffs on Jesus, these chains on Jesus' wrist. And verse 10 tells us, then Simon Peter, having a sword, and that gets my attention, had a sword. I read this whole thing, and that's the first time I see Simon Peter had a sword the whole time. It's awesome. I like this guy, right? Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it. And I'm thinking, I'm reading that going, yeah, this is gonna get so good, right? I've seen Simon Peter pull this huge sword out right in this moment. And he looks at these guys, he's like, freedom, right? It's that moment, man. It's that moment. You're like, yeah, woo! Simon Peter got his sword and he drew it. And he what did he do? He drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. Wah, wah, wah. We just went from this is awesome to that's so lame. Cut off his ear. Like that. What that tells us is Simon Peter is either a really good aim or a really bad aim. And probably really bad. And it's funny to me because we're actually told, by the way, in another one of the Gospels, we're told Jesus actually cleaned up Simon Peter's mess and like picked up the ear and slapped it back on. I love how Jesus can scold Peter while he's healing a guy's ear, putting a guy's ear back on. How awesome is Jesus, right? But listen, isn't that us? Isn't that us where Jesus often cleans up our messes that we make? I love this. I didn't plan on talking about this, but you know we're over time anyway, so let's go. The servant's name, what else is new? The servant's name was Malchus. I love that. John's the only one who gives us the guy's name. John's the only one who gives us his name. Now, many people think, and what's also funny is John's the only one who tells us the guy who cut the soldier's ear off was Peter. Everybody else keeps on the down low. Yeah, there was one of the disciples, they always call him one of the disciples, got a sword and cut off his ear. And I think maybe John didn't like Peter because like, it's Peter. Idiot. He just outs the guy. It's awesome. I'm like, what kind of issues did they have? John's the only one who tells us it was Malchus. There are some scholars who are convinced, and I don't know that we can go with this fully, but I find it interesting. There are some scholars who are very convinced that the reason that John mentions his name and says, hey, by the way, guys, it's Malchus, is because John was written later, considerably later than the other Gospels, and many people believe that by this time, Malchus had actually become a believer. And this was John's way of going, hey, man, I'm serious. This isn't a made-up story. Matter of fact, it was Malchus. Go talk to him. It's an interesting thought. Verse 11, so Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Now, here's the deal, family. I don't know about you, but I'm thinking to myself, like at this moment, if I'm Jesus and this whole thing has happened, and then all of a sudden, like Peter puts an exclamation point on it by drawing the sword and cutting off some guy's ear. At this incredible, at this epic moment, Peter pulls out the sword and cuts off an ear of one of the soldiers. I'm thinking to myself, I mean, honestly, like if I'm Jesus, I'm looking at this guy, are you serious right now? Really? McFly, hello? Seriously? Like 3 years, man. 3 years I have taught you nonstop and you are still a moron. Peter, let's try this again. When I said turn the other cheek, that was not Greek for decapitate some homeboy. I'm thinking if I'm Jesus, I'm losing my patience. But see, Emmaus, here's the point. Here's what you need to see. Peter just did something incredibly stupid. Agree? Peter just did something incredibly stupid. Like, Peter did something that was stupid. And yet, here's the awesome part. Jesus doesn't disown him. I don't know about you, but that truth alone causes me to go, oh, thank God. Because I know what it's like to be stupid. Anybody else? Anybody else? Come on, all the stupid people in the house say, hey, right, hey, stupid, right? We do stupid every day, don't we? Every day. I've probably said 10 stupid things in this sermon. Maybe more. We do stupid every single day. And Peter just did something incredibly stupid. And yet Jesus doesn't disown him. And you know what, family? This isn't even the only stupid thing Peter's going to do in this chapter. And Jesus doesn't disown him. I think about my wife, and it is a miracle that she actually married me. Somebody say amen. That ain't cool, man. I've done a lot of stupid things since we got married, but I did, man, the stupid things I did before we got married. I remember this, I won't tell you all of them because you will have no respect for me as your pastor, but I'll tell you one. There was this moment, we were high school sweethearts. We started dating in the 11th grade. Dated all throughout college, long distance, and then we got married. Basically, you know, as soon as college was over, we got married. And there was this one point in the 11th grade when I had one of our first dates. This is crazy. My wife lived out in the country. We lived out in Lizella, Georgia, right? Lizella, right? You can't even say it without sounding like a hick. And so lived out in Lizella, and it was in the middle of the country, no lights, everything was dark. And so you went there at night, and you couldn't see anything. And my wife lived in she lived in this one house, and the house across the street, they had a huge dog that they would often leave out in the front yard chained up to one of those metal spikes in the yard, right? And this thing was chained up, and it would just bark incessantly at anybody who passed by or walked by. And I get to her house to take her to the movies, and it's pitch black outside, and I'm beginning to walk up to her front door, and I can hear the dog barking hysterically, but I knew it was chained up, so I wasn't too worried about it. And I got to her front door, and I knocked on the door, and her dad, very intimidating father, came and answered the door, and I took her, and we went to the car. We're heading to the movies, and as we're walking to the car, I had my keys out. This is before the key fob, right? This was when you actually had to stick a key into the keyhole and actually unlock the door. I'm old, and I had the car keys with me, and we're walking to the car, and we can hear the dog barking, right? Right, crazy. Cujo, right? Just barking at us. And then, true story, I walk her around to her side of the car to open her door for her, trying to be a gentleman and make a good impression. And as we get over to that side of the car, y'all, we hear this dog barking, and then we heard something snap. And we knew it was the chain when we could hear the dog getting closer. In pitch black, we can't see anything. So we're terrified. She screams, I scream, right? She's like, ah! I'm like, ah, right? And then I got the keys, and she's saying, open the door. I was like, I'm trying, right? It's like one of those really bad horror movies, right? You're trying, you can't get the key, and you're fumbling with it. And then finally, we can hear the dog. You can hear the dog get closer. And I stick the key in, and I unlock it, and I throw the door open, and I jump in first. You'd fact check that too, man. And the miracle is she married me, y'all. What? I mean, listen, aren't you so glad that Jesus doesn't give up on stupid? Man. And then finally we come back, we circle back to where the sermon began in the first place. Look at verse 11 again. So Jesus said to Peter, put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? Emmaus, here's why that's so significant. In the Old Testament, the cup always symbolizes the wrath of God. Look it up later. We won't read the verses. We don't have time. Look it up later. In the Old Testament, the cup always symbolizes the wrath of God. Meaning, here is Jesus right here boldly declaring in verse 11 that nothing, family, absolutely nothing is going to keep him from going to that cross and drinking the cup of God's wrath towards sin so that you won't have to. Nothing's going to keep him from it. And the awesome point that King Jesus is making at this moment is to his disciple Peter is this, family. Jesus is saying, look, man, let's just be clear. I'm in control in the Garden of Gethsemane. Don't let the torches fool you. Don't let the weapons fool you. Don't let the hundreds of Roman soldiers fool you. Don't let all that stuff fool you. I'm in control in the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm not helpless in the Garden of Gethsemane. I know exactly what I'm doing here in the Garden of Gethsemane. Matter of fact, guess what, Peter? Guess what? These guys aren't arresting me. I'm arresting them. They don't even know that I'm in control. And one day, everyone will see that as hard as it was, as dark as it was, as grueling as it was more than worth it to walk through the Garden of Gethsemane. In closing, family, did you notice that all this happens in a garden? Did y'all notice that? Anybody notice that? Do you notice that every single bit of this happens in a garden? You think that's an accident? Anybody think of another place in the Bible where we read about a garden? Where? Quiz. Where? Eden. Very good, Bo. You can stay hired. Love you. Eden. You ever heard of a guy named Adam? Place called Eden. Beloved, please don't miss. Listen, don't miss the sovereign hand of King Jesus writing this story. Not only is he in control, he's writing this story. Adam began his life in the Garden of Eden. Jesus is coming to the end of his life in the Garden of Gethsemane. Adam sinned in the Garden of Eden. Jesus overcomes sin in the Garden of Gethsemane. Adam fell in the Garden of Eden. Jesus conquered in the Garden of Gethsemane. Adam hid himself in the Garden of Eden. Jesus presented himself in the Garden of Gethsemane. The sword was drawn for the very first time in the Garden of Eden. Look it up. The sword was put away in the Garden of Gethsemane. And beloved, Adam ate from the tree, causing the whole world to be cursed by sin in the Garden of Eden. But Jesus committed to drink from the cup of God's wrath, making it possible for the world to be saved from sin in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's in control. He writes the story. He knows what he's doing, and nothing will keep him from accomplishing his purposes. Emmaus, listen, the plan of God will never be thwarted. Not by rebels who oppose Jesus, not by stubborn sinners who ignore Jesus, not by disciples of Jesus who fail Jesus, and not even by presidents. Jesus is king, and he will always have his way. So relax and smile and trust him. Let's pray. And we're going to have a time of communion, worship. For those of you who know Jesus, love Jesus, adore Jesus, follow Jesus, these communion tables, as always, are open for you. The bread representing the body of Jesus. The cup representing the blood of Christ. We take the bread, we dip it in the cup, we eat, and we remember what Jesus Christ accomplished for us. When in Gethsemane, he surrendered himself to drink from the cup of God's wrath so that we would not have to. And he went to the cross, and he who knew no sin became sin on our behalf and rose again the third day, defeating death, hell, and the devil. And he reigns today. And we worship a risen king, a living king, a sovereign king. Jesus, we thank you that you are good. I pray if anyone needs prayer in this place that they would be obedient, respond to the team in back of the cross. I thank you, Lord. I thank you for a lot of things, Lord, but I just want to say thanks that you don't give up on stupid. You don't give up on foolish. Thank you for who you are. We worship you for who you are and for what you've done. It's through Christ I pray.